You tell me where.
I was looking at a map the other day and ended up right next to 6th.
Good afternoon, welcome to House Finance. The time is 1:45. For the record today, we have Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Representative Wyrock, Representative Hawker, Representative Cotula, Co-Chair Meyer, and Co-Chair Chenault. This afternoon, we're going to take up HB 488, Oil and Gas Production Taxes. We'll have a presentation by Anna Darko, and Mark Hanley is the Manager of Public Affairs for Alaska. After that, we've presented some questions to the administration, and I think Robin and Wilson, Dan Dickerson, Roger Marks, and Robert Mintz will either be here or be online to give us the answers to those questions and any others that we might have or that we've thought about since the last meeting. So with that, Mr. Hanley, thank you for being here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Hanley. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Anadarko here in Alaska, and I want to thank you as well for inviting us to testify, allowing us to give you our perspective on a few things related to this bill. I'll just give you an idea. I'm going to give you a brief overview of Anadarko, very brief. Touch on the bill that the governor introduced, give you a few ideas of how we think some of the things in here work, and then I'm going to go through issue by issue some of the key issues that we think need to be discussed and give you our opinion, and I would encourage questions at any time, but particularly, like I said, I'm going to take a little too loud, I'm going to take a number of things issue by issue, and like, you know, we'll go through those and hopefully kind of discuss them as we go rather than wait to the end, because I think it may work better that way. Just to give you a brief overview of Anadarko, we're a large independent. Many of you probably know independent simply means that we explore for and produce oil and gas. We are not integrated. The reason most people don't know the names of most of the independents are we don't have gas stations. So we don't have refineries, we don't have gas stations. Some people would call us small. We're a $23 billion market cap company, relatively large. We have 3,000 employees worldwide. You can see we have operations around the world. Our headquarters are in Houston, Texas. But we do have a number of places that we do work around the world. In Alaska, if you look at the chart here, we are a significant acreage holder of exploration acres. And if you look at the chart, the pink and the yellow are acres that we have an interest in, anywhere from 22% up to 100% interest. The pink acreage is acreage where we have ownership interest, but it is non-operated. In other words, another company is an operator, and that's generally ConocoPhillips. So we were partnered with ConocoPhillips in the Alpine field, where we're a 22% owner. And as you can see, generally everything west out into NPRA, we are partnered with ConocoPhillips. In some of those acres, we are also partnered with Pioneer, but Conoco is also the operator. On the yellow acres that you see up there, we are the operator. We have 100% in some areas, but in a number of areas, we also have a partnership, particularly in the foothills. You may have heard recently we just announced a third addition to our partnership in the foothills. We have Petro-Canada as well as BG, who has not been up here before. So we have a three-way partnership in the foothills where we are the operator, and a fair amount of that acreage down there is Arctic Slope Regional Corporation acreage. So we have an agreement with Arctic Slope Regional Corporation to explore on their acreage, as well as a number of state acres down there. So you can see our net Alaska acreage position, and this was as of about a month ago. It changes almost daily, it seems like, as you get in partners and change your acreage. But we had about 2.2 million net acres, a little over 5 million gross acres that we participate in. And we're right on par with ConocoPhillips for, you know, the most expiration acres net to us as a company. They have more state and federal leases because of our ASRC stuff. That brings us back up in line. So, again, we have
an approach that's a little different than some companies. As you can see, we have a pretty extensive position across the North Slope. We have over 100 leads and prospects on those. We have developed a regional model for the whole North Slope rather than just look at one particular play. And so we have a lot of different options that we think are out here. And I'll just give you an idea. We see Alaska as a great opportunity. We think it has a great petroleum system. It's been proven. We think it has significant resource potential remaining. We think there are legacy-type prospects out there, what we call anchor fields, alpine-sized fields, meaning they can support their own facilities. They do not have to be brought in as satellites into something else. Just because we believe there are those types of fields out there does not mean they're all economic. We'd be drilling them today. Unfortunately, some fields of alpine size that we think may be out there can often be quite a ways from existing infrastructure and may not be economic at this point. So that's one of our challenges. We view Alaska as having a favorable political environment. We think there's a lot of support for the industry up here. Generally, when industry has come to the legislature and the administration for support, whether it's for lengthening the tundra travel season on the North Slope or operating, trying to reduce regulations, we've had favorable response. So we see Alaska as a very favorable place to do business. And finally, as you can see from the last bullet, we think there are abundant new entrants, which we think is a positive thing. There's 10 or 12 new companies working on the North Slope in the last 3 to 4 years. And we see that as a positive for us. We see it as partnering opportunities for our company, but we also see it as helping us learn about what's out there. Frankly, to develop and explore what's out there in Alaska right now, we think a lot more wells need to be drilled. And one company can't do it. So the fact that somebody else may even be our competitors out there drilling is a good thing from our perspective. I tell the story of Total, who came up and bid on acreage in NPRA that the partnership of ARCO and Anadarko did not bid on. They went out and drilled a well. Now, obviously, our companies didn't think that it had the potential that they did, but I can tell you we're not always right. And the fact that they drilled it, I think, was a good thing. And we unfortunately learned from them that I think our view of that particular prospect was correct. But frankly, if they'd hit, we'd all revise our ideas about what was on the North Slope. So the fact that different companies are coming up with different ideas is a positive thing for us and I think for the state. Along with the positive, Alaska also has its challenges. It's a maturing basin. It does have high costs, as you've heard from a lot of people. It has a lack of infrastructure generally. I mean, there's a lot of areas that have potential that are a long ways from existing infrastructure. Extremely long lead time exploration. It's one of the longest places from first idea to production of anywhere we do business in the world. Now, some of that's being helped, but a lot of it's just because you're drilling in the winter season only for environmental reasons. And so what might take you could drill 3 wells in a year. In other places, you can drill 1 well in Alaska with 1 rig. So it takes you a lot longer here. So those are the types of things that affect us. And right now, there's a lack of gas market. There's tremendous potential on the North Slope for additional gas resources. But without a market, obviously, it's not worth much. In fact, people used to call them dry holes even when they hit gas. So, you know, we are very supportive of getting a gas line built. We think it's going to improve the economics of both oil and gas development in the state. And I think it'll actually lead to an even more significant increase in exploration spending in the state.
I'll just give you a brief idea of where we were on the bill as introduced by the governor.
The simple answer is we support it. We thought the administration did a good job of balancing the issues and priorities that were out there. Some people have said, well, how can you pay more in taxes and think it's a good bill? Well, a couple of things. First off, we didn't have a lot to say about it. Three companies came in and said, hey, we're willing to pay up to $1 billion a year more at these prices under this system. And frankly, when they said that, there wasn't much we could do about it. But to be honest with you, going back and looking at it, as the governor negotiated the package,
with the tax rate, the credit rates, as well as the allowances, which are quite important for new players and smaller players, we looked at the bill and we said, look, we're going to pay more in taxes from our production at Alpine, but we are going to get better exploration economics, so more prospects are going to be available. We think it'll lead to more drilling, and that's a positive thing. Plus, there is some downside price protection, so everything on balance for us, we can support the bill. Would it be, is it exactly as we would have preferred it? Probably not if we'd have done it, but it is something that we can support. The answer is yes. Let me go quickly to a... this is an editorial from the Daily News on March 17th, and I think I just want to get focused on some of the issues that's out there. Our view is that the primary issue is declining production. It's going to affect us all. It affects the revenue that the state has, but it also affects the infrastructure because as production goes down, the cost of that pipeline goes up. I mean, the operating costs don't necessarily go down as you put less oil through it, but the amount you have to spread on each barrel goes up. So it can affect all of us as the production goes down. So our goal, obviously, as an explorer is to find more oil to put in that pipeline. We think it is the primary driver of the decline in oil revenues for the state. Let me just go back to... So the way we looked at the governor's bill was if it actually improved our exploration economics compared to the current system, our view is under the current system, there aren't enough wells being drilled. There isn't enough investment going on. And that's starting to change because the price of oil is coming up and people are moving up their estimate of what those prices are. More and more fields are looking economic because the price is coming up. So the way we judged the governor's bill was for new exploration prospects, did it improve them over the current system? If obviously if it was worse than the current system, we wouldn't be supporting the bill because we're going to pay more and it's going to be worse for exploration. As you can see here, the original bill offset the tax increase with credits and allowances that were valuable to all players. And to the extent that changes are made that either increase the tax rate or decrease the allowances, and I mean that in a broad sense, whether it's a progressive tax or the allowance itself or the look back, without credit offsets, then it obviously reduces our economics. Now, how much does it reduce them? That's the question. Is it still better than the existing system? Well, it depends on what your final bill comes out like. But I would just say the goal from our perspective would be, I think Daniel Johnston, who was here before, said if you want more exploration, you got to put a smile on their face. And I would say we're close to having a smile on our face with the governor's bill. With the increased exploration economics, but as you peel some things off from it, that smile starts going away and we're less likely to be comfortable with it. We see it just as a tax increase. Let me go into a chart. This is from Dr. Pedro Van Muir's presentation that he gave to the legislature quite a while back, and I think you guys have all had pages on it, but I want to use this to illustrate just a couple of points. This is his analysis of how explorers would look at a field on a net present value basis based on the different tax rates and the credits that are out there in the allowance. Now, I'll just say this is a 25% tax rate. He didn't do a 2020. That I saw. I mean, I saw a 2015 and a 2520 or 2520. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you some of his, then I'll show you some of ours that are similar for a similar size field that our company's done. And we have different assumptions, and you really need to get your head around some of that. But right now I just want to talk a little bit about the concepts. And what you see on the chart is, as Dr. Van Muir's talked about, the pink line is a 2520 with the $73 million allowance. And what that shows you is the value, and here's the 2520 without the $73 million allowance.
And it shows you the value of the $73 million. It's quite significant. And under his assumptions, the reason it's valuable is for these small fields, which under the current system probably would never have paid a severance tax because of the size and their structure. With the $73 million for new players particularly, they wouldn't pay a severance tax. And that's one of the things when you hear his presentations, to be honest with you, it's a little misleading because under his scenario, you could have 75-20, and for new players, it wouldn't matter, right? The tax rate doesn't have an impact because his assumption is you don't pay any taxes. So it doesn't matter what the tax rate is. That's one of the things that's been left out in the past on some of his analysis, because I would say increasing the tax rate does have an impact, and it decreases your economics. But in this one case for small fields, you can see the value difference there, and it generally runs a line here. The other thing I want to point out, and I'll show you it different, the thing you need to look at right here at the 40, it crosses over. This is the existing system. This is the economics of the existing system. So if you look at the yellow line, it improves your expiration economics through this price range. But when you get to $40 WTI, what happens is if you extended it out, they cross over. And actually, above 40, the expiration economics for a person at that level decrease. So as we look at it, at higher prices, and this is what the system is designed to do. At lower prices, the state takes more of the risk. At higher prices, they get more of the high side. I mean, that's what's going on here. There's a trade-off. And what you see, so there is kind of a balance here because the companies are, quote, giving up some of the high side as well. So when you look at this, is this good for expiration? It can have an impact. And one of the things I'll come back to when we talk about the progressivity that you're discussing is where should that kickoff point be? If you've already got a crossover, and I'll show you one with a 2020 as well. If you've got one with a crossover, where do you want to start that? Where do you? Because what that tends to do when you do the progressive rate, from our perspective, it'll turn this line quicker at whatever point you start that progressive rate. And instead of going up at this angle, it'll flatten it out. So, you know, it's more from the state's perspective, the state's getting more revenue from the progressive tax. From ours, we're getting less. And so the question is, how does that affect our expiration economics? Let me put this down. I'll show you one of ours. And now, again, we had different assumptions on some of these things, but the concept is the same. What you see here is a 2020 with the red line is the 2020 with the $73 million. The green dotted line is the 2020 effectively without the $73 million. So if what we called it was an existing player, if somebody else had production elsewhere, you're going to use your $73 million, or as your bill has a $12 million credit against your existing production, it would not help your expiration economics for your new field because it's being used somewhere else. So you can see the difference, and it's sort of what Pedro had. There's a pretty good chunk of difference there between the red line. What I would say is look at even on the 2020, which is the green line, it's not that far off of where Pedro was. Unfortunately, we used a wellhead price at the bottom. He used WTI. We thought it was more appropriate to use wellhead because that's what you use to evaluate the value. To get an equivalent right now, let's just roughly say add $8 to this. So if the crossover point at 2020 is right here about $32, it's like a $40 WTI price. So again, sort of what he had shown even on the 2520 with a few different assumptions, we're looking at the existing system being better after you get up to higher oil prices from our perspective, but the state's picking up more money. So again, I just want to leave you with the concept. Now, here's our 2520, this line here, and you can see it crosses over sooner. The tax rate's quite a bit lower, and you're going to see that even on Dr. Baker's presentations. As the tax rate goes up, the crossover point comes earlier where the state actually picks up more money, but at a lower price, threshold price. So I just want to leave you with the concepts. We can go into details if people have questions. But again, the $73 million has a value. 20, 2020 is better from an expiration perspective than 2520, and it pay attention to where that crossover point is, because that will make a difference on all of our expiration economics. Let me go back to background. What I'd like to do is talk through a few key issues, and if people have questions as we go through each one, I'm more than happy to discuss them, or we can go through them all however you want, but I just thought it's better to break it out kind of by the primary issues, give you an idea of what we think, how we think about it, and try to give you a recommendation of what we think should be, what we should be done.
Representative Weinrock.
Quick suggestion, as you go through these and talk about the key issues in the context of the bill, could you reference the sections of the bill that you're specifically referring to when you talk
sure.
about it, so we can always bring this discussion back to the bill?
Absolutely. The first one's the tax rate. And that's on page 3, lines 21 through 26 of the bill. And essentially all that does is sets it at 20% on your gross value. I would just say we agree with that. Now, would we like a lower rate? Absolutely. But, I mean, in the process, we think that's an appropriate starting point. We would like to leave it at 20%. As I said, we supported the governor's bill. As I pointed out to you through some of the charts earlier, I think that's as you increase the tax rate, it decreases our economics. So it's going to have that impact. You're going to have less, you're going to have less economic fields, your minimum economic fields. I have some. I've got some. Thank you. I'd like to go into the tax escalator just a little bit. Some people are calling it the progressive tax. Some people will call it the windfall profits tax. I would just say I don't even think it's a windfall profits tax the way it's structured, because it's not on profits, it's on your gross revenue. I mean, it's not on a profit, and that to me is part of the issue. It's on your total. And as I read the bill, and that's on page 4, really line 7 through 7 through 15, but through the end of the page there. It's a little different than most people think of, too. I think some people I've talked to believe that once you get above $50 a barrel, then you pay a higher rate on that increment above 50. The way this works, from what I can see, is you pay the increment on the whole thing. And, in fact, if you look at it like you do your income taxes, let's just say you made $50,000 a year, or that was the break point for the federal government, and let's say they had a 20% tax rate up to $50,000, and then above that, from $50,000 to $80,000, they had a 23% tax rate, let's just say, or something. But let's say you made, so at $50,000, your tax rate is 20%, you'd pay $10,000 in taxes. If you went and made $60,000, your tax rate wouldn't be 23%, and that's the 23% rate. Your tax rate wouldn't be 23% on the $60,000. Your tax rate would be 20% on the $50,000, and it would be 23% on the $10,000 on the increment. So this one is opposite that. I mean, this is 23%. Once you get above that rate and you trigger that deal, the 23% applies to the whole $60,000. I mean, you can do whatever you want to do, but I would just say it's not even a normal windfall profits type tax. It's pretty onerous. One of the other issues that has been raised is that costs are not considered. The $50 today. Well, let's look at 10 years from now. Let's say we've got this gas line being built. And I can guarantee you that's going to be a good thing for all of us, but I can almost guarantee you that our costs are going to go up substantially. Steel costs are going to be out of this, out through the roof because of China and because of the two pipelines, the Mackenzie Delta and here. Labor costs. You've already heard there aren't enough laborers to build these pipelines almost anywhere. How do you think that's going to affect us trying to drill our rigs, you know, work our rigs and do pipes? So there will be cost increases, substantial ones. So if the assumption is that above $50 we're kind of getting a windfall, what if our costs go up 50%? There's no calculation for that in here, and because it's on the gross, not the net, I would say that's a concern for us. And there needs to be either apply it to the net or have some kind of cost factor involved so that it doesn't affect us, where we have costs going up but are and assuming that we're getting more money when we actually aren't. And then the last thing related to the tax escalator is $50 the right number to start it at? And I think as you heard from the ConocoPhillips folks yesterday, and how people make decisions, you saw the tornado charts, we generally work the same type of process. We don't share our economics or our numbers with people, but the process is generally the same. And I would just say that this is taking away the upside for us, and it is being used. Some of the economists or some people around here from listened to some of the presentations by consultants, suggested, look, the companies look at $40 is what they said is their base price, and then they will, that's the hurdle rate that you have to get over. Well, they're not far off. Different companies use different numbers, and we'll stress it at a low price to see if there's still cash flow, say 30, but they didn't mention anything about the upside. And I'll tell you, companies do use the upside, and I think it was Representative Hawker that used the bell curve example. And it's probably a good analogy because, but I would just say $50 is pretty well inside that bell curve where it does have an impact on our decision making. And if your goal is to, look, if somebody goes and attacks the Saudi field today and the price goes up to $100 a barrel tomorrow, our cost didn't go up. There's no question. If your goal is to capture some of that, our preference would be you just leave it. But if you're going to do this, I would say start that thing outside the range of where our decision making actually happens. And so that you leave the opportunity for those exploration economics to be the best. And I'm going to show you a chart from the Econ 1 presentation. And this is the USGS. I believe they took these numbers from the United States Geological Survey. And what you see is a chart showing the economic oil reserves in the Central North Slope at different prices. And I don't have this in the book. I didn't actually make a copy of it. I can get you one, but it was their presentation. And what it shows you, as the prices go up, obviously more and more oil becomes economic. But if you start lopping, you know, if government take starts going away, it effectively decreases the price from our perspective, and you're going to decrease the amount of the fields that are economic. You're going to have a larger minimum economic field sizes. So I would just say, you look at this range in here, and you know, pick what you want. But I would say, if you get up in that $60 range before you start increasing your taxes or having the escalator, then I would say you've given yourself the best opportunity. Part of the problem here is we are lagging behind, and we're getting hit twice on this, I guess, because some people. We can't plan on $60 oil prices. We can't, because if we did, we'd have a problem, because we know things are going to go up and down, and particularly in Alaska, where it takes us longer to develop things from start to finish. You know, I tell people, you know, if you can tell me that the oil price is going to be $60 from 2014 till 2034, then I think there's a lot of things we'd go drill. But that's the problem. We are being conservative. We are using numbers closer to the 40. But as you start taking that extra amount as the prices go up and as we gradually move our price forecast up, you're limiting some of the economically recoverable reserves. And I think that's a danger. Just so you know, they suggested that the total economically recoverable reserves, I think, under their study were about $4.1 billion. So you can see at 60, you're getting pretty close to most of what's economically recoverable. Here's the number of fields at the different prices, so you can get an idea of the kinds of fields. So at $40, you can see you've got 12 fields at 50 million barrels, get five fields at 100, two fields at 150, and maybe one alpine-sized field. If you get up to $50 a barrel, then you can see you start getting some, particularly in the 100, 150 million barrel range, you start getting some pretty significant fields become economically available. Now, this is just assumptions, but again, it makes the point that I think we would like to make, which to the extent you're comfortable, start that thing higher. And I guess our suggestion would be two things. Place your increase on the net so you take care of costs. Start it at 55. If you want to use West Texas, this is the other issue too. Are you using West Texas as your marker point? Well, to be honest with you, as we get more and more heavy oil through the pipe, which hopefully there will be because that's one of the huge reserves out there, but the quality difference is significant. And that $8 between West Texas and the North Slope right now could be as high as $12 or $14. I mean, the difference between there could be significant. And what's going to happen is as West Texas prices go up, you're assuming that people are making more money when actually, because of the different quality effect, you are not. And so, again, is it really the right thing to do? The concept may be right, but the application without having a cost factor and without having the right differential there, and I would suggest that you should probably use a North Slope wellhead value for that escalator if you're going to do it. So those are our suggestions on the on that particular issue, which is, you know, if it were me, I'd go to $55 and use ANS North Slope. Now, I need to be fair. What that means is it's equivalent to, would I rather have $70? Absolutely. You know, I'm trying to be realistic in the scheme of things, but at $55 in an ANS North Slope is equivalent to probably a $63 WTI. So now you're getting up above that $60 range, and that's what I would say. However you want to do it, if you want to use WTI, I'd say go to 65. If you want to use ANS North Slope, I'd say go to at least 55. And, you know, obviously I'd push for higher, but I think you get in that range where you're starting to see, and, you know, some people call it leaving money on the table. I'd say leave yourself some opportunity to keep the exploration economics and the investment economics for folks there, and you still capture your high side. If the price goes to $100 a barrel, you're getting some of that that's out there. Don't nickel and dime this thing so much, and I think you shave it too close, and you are going to have that negative impact, or you won't get the increased investment that you're hoping to have to keep that decline from happening.
Representative Weirach?
He answered my question.
Okay. Representative Hawker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just flesh out this one we've been talking with everybody that's been before us on. The argument on the issue of going to an ANS factor or pegging it on a WTI, the argument that I've heard put forward is that with the dominance of Alaska's production by three major players, they have an ability to unduly influence that price and index and would be able to essentially, you know, game the system to the state's detriment. Do you have any thoughts on that subject?
Chair, I'm not one of the guys that has enough oil to be able to potentially do that. I would just say if they can do it, they should be doing it now. I mean, I'm not the one to answer that, but I would just say it's to their advantage to have, you know, the highest wellhead value that they can get. I don't know. I guess you could find a scenario where if they could have a lower wellhead value, somehow the tax rate doesn't kick up as much. I see it hard. I mean, I guess I'm not the right person to answer, but just conceptually I find it hard to believe that they would find the ability to move some ships or something to decrease or increase that or decrease the wellhead value through increased transportation costs. I mean, I think if they could do it, why wouldn't they do it now? Because it would have the same impact on their severance taxes now. But anyway, I
might do a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, sir. So, you know, I appreciate that response. You're the first person that's brought before us the distinction between ANS West and wellhead, kind of into the dialogue we're in here. It would seem I mean, just again, in the hypothetical that we're establishing some kind of a, you know, an index upon which something else is going to be determined, we'd want that index to be as objective, as verifiable, and as independent as possible, and I guess indeterminable as possible. Do you think that Wellhead is just, you know, meets all those criteria as well as just the West Coast pricings?
Chair, Representative Hawker, I would say that you've got the concept that it needs to be fair. You shouldn't be able to game it. It ought to take into account the actual factors that are out there, and I would get other people that know better. You're going to have to probably have an average wellhead. I'll just tell you, it gets very complicated because there are different wellheads on the North Slope. Are you going to use a pump station one? At Alpine, we've got another buck transportation cost to get to our wellhead because the pipeline's further away. So there are issues no matter how you do this. But I would just say you have to figure out what a wellhead is because that's how you determine the value of the oil. It's done today. There is a system to do it. And it seems to me that you could utilize the same system to come up with a fair system if you're looking for an escalator.
And thank you. It puts on the table that wellhead, there's a lot of different challenges with writing a structure around wellhead as there would be around West Coast.
Sure.
Thank you.
Next,
the $73 million allowance, which has been turned by the Resources Committee into a $12 million credit. We're very supportive of that. Obviously, we'd rather have the $14 million credit. That's equivalent, essentially, of the – it was slightly reduced, but we're supportive of having that credit. And I will just tell you, as Dr. Van Meurs and the administration has said, this is much more valuable to smaller players and new players than it is to larger players that are existing. You saw the lines for new players that didn't have production in the difference. That demonstrates that value. I would just say for us as a company, Granite Arco, if you got rid of the $73 million, it would be like increasing our tax rate to 25%. That's kind of the equivalent impact it has. Now, if you take a large company, one of the larger slope producers, and reduce the $73 million, it would be like taking their tax rate to 20.5%. So I just want to give you the relative value because we have smaller production. It has a bigger relative impact on us, and it is worth more. And I think the governor recognized that, and that's part of this balance of the package. Not everybody was thrilled with all the things in the package. I called it a tenuous truce between the companies with the governor's bill because people think we're all aligned, and I will tell you, of course, those bigger companies would have traded the $73 million off for a 1% decrease in the tax rate. Now, for us, you'd have to have a 5% tax rate decrease for us to trade it off. So was everything the same? Absolutely not. Did it work for us? Yes, it did, which is why you hear, as things get pulled apart, there are differences. So the $73 million allowance, which was turned into a $12 million credit, I think is valuable. We support it. The one thing I would say is the fact that the House Resources version has a sunset on that, and that is on page,
On the credit?
On the $73 million credit. It's page 24, I think, line 13. So if you look at the...
Correct.
Is that correct? Yes. So it's basically a 10-year sunset. So after 10 years, it does not apply. What I will tell you that does... particularly for new players, that red line that you saw that was so much better for new players on the expiration economics, it's pretty much gone. Because for a new player, let's say somebody comes in today and goes and buys leases, the odds that they will have any production against which to apply a credit within 10 years are pretty small. Or if they do, they'll only get 1 or 2 years worth of production. So effectively, that sunset on that credit means that it has no value for explorers. So that red line is pretty much gone. A lot of the things for new players, it isn't going to help. So, of course, our pitch would be
to eliminate the sunset. That means, as the governor's original bill did, it just kept going. So I just want to point that out. That's one of our recommendations. The transition allowance. I guess I should pause and see if there's questions.
On that point, just to review your testimony, you had, I don't know if you'd finished your thought. You said the resource version had turned the $73 million into a $12 million credit.
Correct.
And that $14 million was equivalent to, and that's where you hadn't finished your thought.
Representative Weirach, through the chair. Because of the 20% tax rate, when it was an allowance, or effectively the $73 million was the equivalent of a $14.6 million credit.
There you go. Okay, thank you.
Okay. And effectively what they did is reduce the $73 to $60 million and then turned it into a credit, which became a $12 million credit. So there was a slight reduction in it. Again, we'd prefer to see it up, but obviously we're supporting the $12 million. The one thing I would say is we are hoping that you will, if the intent is to encourage new players and smaller players, then the fact that that sunsets, particularly for new expiration, will have a, it effectively eliminates it for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, I don't know, did you catch the department's presentation to us earlier this week when they were presenting the credit points? And I think one of the things that came out of that before us was that just with the way the credit's currently structured and the way this, the capital expenditure deduction is allows, that an individual, that an entity making a capital expenditure, say $5 million, because of the benefit of both the CapEx and the cap credit, would get a benefit of $6 million. Did you follow that discussion at all?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I did not see their presentation.
And that's why I'd just like that sometime if we could get together, I'd like to walk through that, because it seems, if in fact that is the proper analysis, it didn't seem correct to me to have, you know, basically for, if you spend five for the state to give you a bonus of one, you know, I'd certainly be very happy to consider giving the, you know, the full value of the investment, which is the intent to incent a small player. But I'd sure like to run, see, kind of pit you and Department of Revenue against each other and kind of see how we come out with the numbers.
Again, I did not see the presentation. My impression of the way, at least the way it is supposed to work, is the credit is non-sellable, non-transferable, non-carry-forwardable. It applies only after you've taken all your other deductions and credits. So to the extent that there is, it seems hard to, I'll just have to see how they came up with the fact that you could actually get a higher credit than you spent. It seems to me you could get your taxes down to zero, but
the double deduction thing is what results in the extra benefit.
Okay. Well, I'll be happy to.
Second point.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I maybe just almost more of a side note for the committee than Mark in front of us, but he brings right to the point. This $12 million, as presented here, $12 million credit, its intent is really to benefit the explorers, the smaller players, but as the bill is written, it's really a universal credit. Everybody gets advantage of it, from the biggest player down to the smallest. And it's just one of those, in that it is intended to benefit the small players. I'm not really so sure that it's something that, as a policy call here, we'd want to make available to the big players as well as the small players. But you know, and in doing that, you know, typically in tax structuring, you've got phase-out provisions that under some peg and benefit or some benchmark, the credit becomes less and less available. And I, you know, in this case, probably in relation to someone's cumulative annual production or some such. But I guess, Mark, with that sort of soliloquy, would a structure like that, do you think something, you know, could be worked? And do you have any guidance on how at the lower end, what kind of production levels we might want to take into consideration to make sure they, the people that ought to be getting this credit are getting the credit?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, obviously that's a policy call. I think you guys can draw the line. You know, as again, the way the governor presented it, all the companies, in fact, the existing companies that have production got it. So, you know, big, small. That was how we presented an equity issue across the board. And I think, frankly, the trade-off from that was a higher tax rate. I mean, just because you have that, if your goal is to get a net amount of income and you have some credits and allowances like this, then you have a higher tax rate and you still get there from there. Some people look at it as a giveaway. I would say it creates an incentive for certain folks and it applies to everybody, so it's more equitable across the board. Obviously, you can do, as you said, Representative Hawker, you can create any kind of criteria you choose to where you want to draw that line off. But depending on how you structure it, it will have an impact on certain companies.
And that would be a ridiculous answer. Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then the transition allowance. That's on, there's not much of a transition allowance left in the governor's original bill had it. With the five-year look back, you want to call it, or the transition allowance. I believe on page 27, lines 24 through 27 is the transition, which effectively allows you to get a credit for the first 3 months of the year. That's the existing transition provision. And I think Mr. Bowles yesterday, since we are both partners in the same area, did a pretty good job of explaining at least how we see the issue. In December of 2004, Anadarko, we submitted our approval to go ahead with two satellites, Nanook and Fjord. Prices were pretty high. We submitted our approval to go ahead. The governor came out with his aggregation decision just in January of that year. Basically, we put our projects on hold to see how it was going to affect us, because in the previous time, those satellites would not have been aggregated and would not likely have paid much, if any, taxes because of their size and well production, et cetera. So we're not likely to pay severance tax. Went through a negotiation process with the administration. As Mr. Bowl said, have a letter suggesting that for 6 years they would not be aggregated. So at least for 6 years after startup, we would have essentially very low, if no, severance taxes. And we made the decision to go ahead. So here we come along into this process, and we spent over $400 million, not us, that's net, that's gross, I mean, to the fields, but, you know, I think we're 22% of it, so you can figure out it's probably $100 million for us. In 2005 and ongoing today, on getting those satellites that are supposed to start production this year, we haven't had a chance to depreciate them, recover any capital from them, we haven't had a chance to take advantage of the high oil prices, and we will get hit with a higher tax rate. I will tell you, if we knew this was coming, and there's always this risk, don't get me wrong, but if we knew this was coming, I can almost guarantee you we would have put off for a year and a half spending any of that money, because we would effectively have gotten the 20% deduction and credit. The state would be picking up 40% of our costs, and we would be paying a higher tax rate, but the trade-off would have been okay. The way it's going to work now with no transition, essentially, we won't get any credits or deductions, but we will pay the higher tax rate. So, you know, it's an equity issue. There's no question about it. So I guess our pitch is that we think there should be some look back for certain provisions. We think it's we would argue it's fair for those people that made decisions in the past based on what the rules were, and particularly with such a significant change. It's going to have a significant impact. So we would argue for, you know, you've heard the House Resources was considering some look back. It's staggered. We've heard 2-for-1 kinds of things. Obviously, we'll take anything we can get, but I would just suggest that something more substantial than is what this current bill would be appropriate.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or Chairmans. And I suspect I'm probably jumping the gun on my friend Mr. Kelly across the hall here. I think we certainly, Rep. Kelly and I have been looking at the 2-for-1 proposal that's been kicked around in the Senate. Certainly looked at the way that it came out in the original governor's bill. I had some concerns, frankly, about 5-year look back being, you know, whether that was correct or not. I'll be honest, I don't have an honest answer. I mean, I just don't have an empirical answer to that. But could or I guess maybe just your comments and thoughts on what you think of a the idea of the 2-for-1, which is really a performance-based reward more so than just an assured credit provision.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we intend to spend some money in the future, so it will allow us to get some of that money back. I would think if you can give us a little bit of time in the future to keep getting that 2-for-1, it would be more beneficial because, frankly, things like this just don't turn around. We do have other satellites we're developing or hoping to develop. We're going to have some exploration that's going on. But if you make it for 3 years into the future, it's not, you know, we're not going to have time to, you know, it's only projects that are already on the books. If you want to have the impact or that you have some incentive from going and doing this, I think you need to leave people the opportunity to go out and explore and hopefully develop. So I would say if you're going to do a kind of a 2-for-1, then extend it out a little further into the future. Don't make it a 3 or 5 year thing. I would think give it 10 years, and that gives people time to actually impact their exploration program, go out and drill something, maybe develop something, and have that money spent so they can capture some of the money that was spent in the past.
Thank you.
Okay. Point of production. This is on page, well, the definition is on page, it's probably best to go to, let's go to page 17, lines, I can't even read my handwriting, I think it's 5 through 16. Yeah. That's section 26 of the bill. It basically says the point of production shall be calculated using reasonable cost of transportation of the oil and gas. And the concept here is where they measure a point of production, then to get to the wellhead, you essentially start somewhere, West Coast, or for gas, you start at Henry Hub, and you work your way back and take out the reasonable cost of transportation. And that's what you multiply times that production at that point of production, okay? So that makes sense, that whole concept. But go to page 25, lines. If you start there in section 34 on line 24, it starts describing what the gross value at the point of production means. Now, the first thing they talk about is for oil, it talks about the value at the automatic custody transfer meter or device. Basically, it talks about where you measure the oil, where it goes into a pipeline in pipeline quality. So essentially, everything it takes to get oil into pipeline quality is upstream of the point of production. So if you've got treatment facilities and taking out the water, all of that stuff, for oil, that's where the point of production is. And that seems to make sense. So essentially everything upstream from that is going to qualify for the credits, and it's going to qualify for the deductions. Now if you look at gas, on the following page, they have a different point of production. And the point of production is essentially upstream of any treatment facility. That's the way you can read this. That's the simple answer of reading this, at least the way we read it. So the treatment facility is not included for purposes of the credits and the deductions. The issue for us, and I think, and I'm speculating a bit here, but I think what people are thinking about is for the new gas contract that's out, I think that maybe the treatment facility is being handled as part of the gas contract. I don't know for sure. But for those of us that may explore for gas in the foothills, that may have our own treatment facilities, people that are exploring in the Nanana Basin that may have their own treatment facilities, people exploring at Cook Inlet, it seems to me that you should be able to include any facility that treats your gas to get it to pipeline quality, because otherwise it seems like there's a blank in between of how you're going to account for that cost. And in fact, I think I'll talk a little bit about this in a second, but gas economics tend to be not quite as robust as oil economics, and the fact that you may be leaving out facilities that are required to get your gas actually in a sellable product, and you aren't, for some people, are not going to have that ability to
get the tax credits and deductions, it's going to hurt the economics of gas. So I guess we are a little concerned about, and I've heard that we may be able to take advantage of the gas contract provisions. I don't know what they are. I haven't seen them. We're kind of in the blind. But I would just say, as a general policy, without seeing this, I'm still concerned about the fact that there's a different point of production with some facilities required to get your gas in sellable condition that are not included as part of the... So I guess we would like to see the point of production moved downstream.
Was this a concern raised at the Resources Committee? Was this added in at the Resources Committee, or has this been in the bill throughout? On the gas issue.
Chair Representative Weirach, I believe it's been in the bill throughout. I do not believe we raised it. As we go through here, we understand more and more about what issues there are. And,
okay, well, I'll just talk to the administration.
Representative Kelly?
Just on that issue and several that relate particularly to the smaller companies. Might be helpful if you would propose specific language that you think would solve the problem, because I think, you know, we're focusing on the majors and we're getting the cranks turning on all the language and options there, and it may be helpful if you it would be, to me anyway, to hear from you on how you think these 4 points or so that you've talked about that are fairly significant ones could be solved in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly, we'll do that. Again, I guess we probably need to talk to the administration a little bit more, too, because I feel like we're there are things going on that we don't understand how they're working, which are affecting this, and we may not understand them exactly correctly either, but from our reading, it's clear that point of production does not include the treatment plant. It's not clear how you would get the value. Now, is there a cost allocation method that you can use to reduce your wellhead value? If that's the approach they're going to take, that might work. But as I said, in the definition, it's transportation costs you get to deduct to get to your wellhead value, not treatment costs. So it seems to us that there's a bit of a black hole for a particular facility where there's no, you know, we're kind of left in the middle. So I will talk to the administration and see. I mean, our approach would be just to put it after the treatment plant, but I think there's other things going on that they don't want to do that.
Well,
Representative Kelly?
Following, you know, most of us here haven't done one of these before, and most of us, once this thing's put to bed, won't do another one. So this is kind of breaking some new ground here and there. It just seems to me that in some of the language as we go along over the next couple of weeks, if you had language that then the administration, for example, said in the context of their bill, they think they agree with you, that your language solves the problem. I'm just trying to figure out how to jump over a few spaces here. I don't care how the word gets to us, but I think because the advocacy for your size operation is maybe a little less than the majors, we need you to get in there and swing when we're missing something or you think we're missing something, just to make sure we get a look at the options. Thank you.
Representative Curtula.
Thanks, Mark. Talking about the facilities, there's a subtraction from what the producers can use for their deductions, and it's back on page 22, actually, you know, starting on page 21, dealing with it, but in lines 1 and 2 on the top of page 22, it looks like the producers have to subtract a payment received for the use by another person of a production facility in which the producer has an ownership interest from those things that they can deduct from their lease expenditures. And so it looks to me like that might cause a problem with an explorer, someone coming in and wanting to use a producer's facility. And I just wondered if you guys have thought about that at all, too. I mean, it's not right on point, with what you're talking about, but it's just something that caught me in terms of access issues.
Through the chair. Yeah, it could, I guess. I understand the intent there is if a facility at Prudhoe or Kuparuk gets a satellite from a third party and is getting paid $5 a barrel to process that, it's income to them. Yeah. And so I think the state's goal is to say you can't deduct that, and there is actually income to you that should be offset. Now, is it going to have a negative impact on the guys trying to sell it, the third party trying to bring it in? Is it going to make it even less likely that they're willing to take that oil? I don't know.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Hawker.
Mr. Chair, on this gas point of production value here, and in parts, I really don't know where I'm going with this one, but it seems, again, as written, this was to move the point of production determination as far upstream as possible. And you make the argument for why you would want it as far downstream as possible. Is this provision, and does this issue also include the whole hypothetical development of Point Thompson, that this provision would try to take the point of production closer to the unit boundary rather than so far downstream that there'd be a lot of cost creditable that we, as a policy call, we might not want to make creditable on a Point Thompson development?
Parker, through the chair, I do not know how they're going to develop Point Thompson. We're not an ownership, but my understanding is I think there will be, I don't know if they're going to have a separate gas treatment facility at Point Thompson. If they are not, if they're using the central gas treatment facility, and that is not included, then I would think everything kind of upstream from the gas treatment facility would be included as far as development at Point Thompson. But I do not, that's a better question for the administration, for the companies that are actually owners. I would just say for us, or for other people in Cook Inlet or Nanana Basin, if we have to have a treatment facility that's separate, it seems like it ought to be included, just like it is for oil, to get pipeline quality gas. I'm not sure how that interplays with other things that are going on relative to the special case of Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay that may be addressed.
We're going to have the administration later today, I think. So. Thank you. Excuse me for taking off in the wrong direction there.
Mr. Chairman, the last 2 points, the gas economics, it kind of feeds right into what we've been discussing. A lot of people were not, frankly, thinking about gas economics because I think there seems to be this perception that's taken care of as part of the gas contract. It's unclear to us whether those of us that are not negotiating that will be able to get the terms and conditions. We've heard some people say we might be able to. It's unclear whether we're going to have our own contract, what are those terms and conditions. But right now, I would just say the gas economics are typically worse than oil. I think Daniel Johnston said, average government take across the world for oil is 65% or something like that. And he said the average government take on gas around the world is 10 points less, 55%. It doesn't take, you can just look at the relative value of transportation versus the overall value of the product. Right now, the price of oil, $65 a barrel today? Let's say it takes $4 for a TAPS tariff and $2 for a tanker to get to the West Coast, $6, right? So it's 10%. Tariffs are talking about on gas, $2.50, that kind of range on a $6.50 or $7 price. I mean, the transportation is a much higher percentage of the cost, so it's not quite as economic. And so I don't think there's been a lot of consideration as to whether there should be. And again, I'm looking at new gas. I don't know about the existing gas. The existing gas is totally different economics. There's no expiration risk. There's no production risk per se, at least from Prudhoe Bay. It is being handled as part of the gas contract. When you look at, again, Cook Inlet and Nanana Basin, foothills on the North Slope, the existing law that we have for severance tax
oil severance tax starts at 12.5%, goes up to 15 after 5 years. It is modified by an ELF, obviously, but that's the base rate. Gas starts at 10%. It doesn't go up. It has its own ELF. So in current statute, we have a differentiation between the tax rates for gas and oil. Mm-hmm. And I would just say the escalator, I raised this issue in the Resources Committee, and the escalator, if you notice, for gas, you have a separate gas escalator for the tax escalator. It starts at $8 an MCF. Now, it is higher on a relative basis than the $50 oil. And part of that was because of some comments that it's less economic. They were going to start that higher and leave some of that additional ability. That was one way they're trying to help the economics of gas, I guess. But I just raised that issue, and I know some of the consultants were going to potentially look at what gas economics were. And, you know, I can come in here and argue that we should have a lower tax rate and everything else. But I think you should get your own consultants to tell you from the people you hire, because I do think there is a difference, and let them help you make the policy call as to whether there should be some either extra incentives for gas. And again, I'm talking outside of the, because I don't know what's going on with Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, but for new expiration, should there be a different tax rate or different incentives? And that's a consideration.
Representative Kelly?
The tie SB 85 extension into that, could you please, into what you were just talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly. That's my last point on the.
I'll wait.
Thank you, on the thing, but I'm happy to.
No, I'll wait.
Representative Catrilla?
I can go through. I can go into that now. One of the positive things, as they did some changes, you know, they had the escalator, reduced the allowance, reduced, almost eliminated the look back. They did add some additional. And I believe those are on page, page, I have 12, line 2. That's the extensions of the, it's actually starts on page 11, line 16, section 15 and 16 on 11 and 12. They took the existing expiration incentive credit system, which, if you remember, is the 20% if you're more than, if you're outside a unit boundary and more than 3 miles from an existing well, and you can get another 20% for an expiration well, just one well, if you're more than 25 miles from a unit boundary. So you could get up to 40%. And what they did is added an extra expiration incentive, which actually helped bring back, it's this relative relationship, as they increased the tax rates, they gave us some more incentive for expiration. So that was a positive. And we see that is very positive. We'd like to keep that in the bill. And we think the extension that they gave, which was a 10-year extension of those credits, is appropriate. You can review that. Now, the difference of why you wouldn't want to eliminate why a 10-year extension on the $73 million credit is a problem is because that applies to production, right? So somebody may not be able to get production in that 10 years. This 10-year extension on the expiration credit is on the expiration well itself. So people will have time to come up and get leases and actually implement this and utilize the value of that credit on that particular well. So a 10-year extension is appropriate. You guys can look and see whether you want to continue that in 10 years, but it will have the impact that it's supposed to, which is encouraging additional expiration. Now, the way it's structured, you can either take the what I call the EIC credit, which is the is it 185? SB 185 bill extensions, or the 20% credit. You can't take both. So I suspect for the ones that are close into infrastructure that aren't 25 miles from a unit, you'll just utilize the 20% under the PPT. If you have a bigger well, you know, if you're farther away and you're doing an expiration well, you can get up to another 20%, then you will use that one where you'll essentially get a 40% credit. It's effectively less than 40% because the definition doesn't allow as many costs to be included, but you'll probably utilize that on some of those further wells. So I don't know if that answered your question.
And that, just because I don't remember, that applies to gas and oil equally, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I found the 10-year extension. I think it's on page 12 of section 16. To July 1, 2016, that's what you were referring to, right? But then you also said there was something else, a credit addition. Was that the 40% in subsection 4 of the total expiration expenditures? Mm-hmm. They added another 40%?
Through the chair, could I ask which were you looking at?
Yeah, I'm looking at section 15. It's page 11 of the bill that you referred to, the CS mm-hmm. in front of us, page 3rd, line 28-29.
Through the chair, Representative Weirock, that is actually... They didn't change anything in the existing statute.
I see. Okay.
They just allowed it to apply this production
for
credit to the tax due under the new PPT, I believe is what they did. And if you want to look at page 8, line 7, that is where they have basically said you can either take the 20% credit under the PPT, or you can take this EIC credit, which is that 43. It says unless a credit is taken under 4355025, which is that section you were just looking at. So effectively, that's where it differentiates between the two and says you can either take the 20% credit, or you can use the credits in the existing law that have been extended for 10 years. So, Mr. Chairman, again, appreciate the opportunity to test it. Oh.
Just one.
Gil.
Mark, does that 185 solve the problem on the gas? Not the production point, but you had some concerns. Obviously, it helps, but does it solve it?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I don't believe so. I mean, it helped offset some of the other changes, and it applies to both oil and gas. It did help offset some of the other changes that were made, you know, reducing the credit to $12 million. But again, it's not quite as valuable as the credits in the PPT because, frankly, those apply to your first exploration well, your delineation wells, your development wells, your development costs, all the whole line. This is a very limited... only applies to that first expiration well as long as it meets certain criteria being far away. So it helped offset some of the things, but it did not fundamentally change the question of whether gas is disadvantaged versus oil.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mark. Appreciate your presentation today. Take about a 2-minute break or 5-minute break, and we'll be back in a couple.